Off the Ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.
Now to a piece we're really looking forward to. Our next guest has scored goals at Croke Park, Windsor Park and the World Cup. A bit mad. He's also been the voice of Spanish football for 20-odd years. Jerry Armstrong, lovely to have you with us.
Hi, Joe. How are you?
Very well. You're up in Belfast?
I'm back in Belfast now over the last 8 months, yes.
And planning to stay for the foreseeable?
For the time being, anyway. It depends on work, Joe, as you know. I've been living in Spain for nearly 6 years. And I've been working on lots of different Spanish football La Liga for over 20 years.
And you enjoyed your time in Spain, I presume?
Yes, it's good. It's a good place to live, but there's not as much work there as you would find back in the UK. So that's one of the reasons why we're back home.
Okay. And you're still keen to keep working and stay involved in the game and commentary, and you enjoy it?
I love it. I love listening to football, watching football. You know, when you grow up as a sportsman and your life's been sports and football all your life, basically you don't know anything else.
Jerry, I should tell the listeners how this idea came about to chat to you, really, because it might seem a bit random to them. We were ringing you on Monday to get your thoughts on the Gareth Bale situation, and our producer JP rang you, and I think, according to him anyway, you spent the first 5-10 minutes yapping on about the hurling and how brilliant it was, and then you told him that you had played for the Antrim Footballers right up until you went to the UK, that you'd only started playing organised football at 17, and we thought, well, JP, you must have heard wrong, or this can't be right. So we said, let's get him on and see if all this is true. And it pretty much is true.
Yeah, I only played Gaelic football in hurling till I was probably 16, 17. And that was my sport. I played Gaelic football for St John's GAC club up in Belfast. And at 15, I made my debut for the senior football team at Casement Park in an Ulster club championship match. And then I became a regular in the senior team at St John's at 16, 17. And at 17, I was able to play minor, under 21 and senior for Antrim. And I did. I used to play back-to-back games. I'd play a minor game and then straight after it, I'd play an under 21 game up in Derry or Tyrone or wherever it was. And I won a lot of Ulster, a lot of Antrim medals, obviously, with St John's GAC club championship. And played in a lot of Ulster finals. But when I was 17 and a half, we played the All-Ireland hurling final against Tipperary at Croke Park in 1971. And it was Antrim against Tipperary, and we were a couple of goals down early on, but we came back to win it. And I think it's the only All-Ireland hurling title that Antrim has ever won. And then the following week, I came back as the captain of the vocational schools Gaelic team. And we lost to Mayo in the final by a point in Croke Park again. Both games were at Croke. And a great experience, obviously, fantastic. But in the hurling one, it was interesting because when we played hurling, there was no other teams wanted to participate in Ulster, County Down, and obviously Fermanagh and Tyrone and Armagh didn't have a vocational schools team. So Antrim were put into the Leinster section, and I won a Leinster medal as well because we won the Leinster championship and then went on to the semis in the All-Ireland final.
She's extraordinary. I didn't realise it was that accomplished either. So that, is that the guts of 3-4 years as well playing senior football for Antrim?
Yeah, I played at least 4 years. I played from I was 17 until I was 21. Wow. Today, I was supposed to play for Antrim at Casement Park, and I got a phone call, obviously, to tell me that the transfer deal was going through. I played football on a Saturday for Bangor FC in the Irish League, and they told me that basically the transfer deal was going through on the Sunday, and I had to be at the hotel in just outside Belfast, the Dunaudry Inn, it was called. And I went there to meet, I thought I was signing for Arsenal, to be honest, because I've been speaking to them quite a bit. And I had been over on a trial with Tottenham, and I thought they'd just not fancied me. And anyway, I turned up and Terry Neal was there, and he said, "You're signing for Tottenham."
Wow.
And I signed for Spurs and negotiated the contract, and away I went.
I have a random quote from the Irish News, August 18th, 1975, reporting on the All-Ireland Under-21 semi-final. Paddy O'Shea could make no fist of Jerry Armstrong, who roamed out the field and left Kerry defenders flat-footed with his devastating bursts of speed. Did you write this?
I didn't hear that one. Now, that's it's interesting. I haven't read a lot of these reports, but No, I know Paddy very well, and I knew Paddy very well. I went to see him a couple of times down in Kerry, and had a couple of great nights with him down in his bar. And we had a lot of memories to go over. And that semi final was one. He said I embarrassed him in front of his own people because he couldn't. Yeah. But Mick O'Dwyer had warned him apparently beforehand. Pat Spillane told me that Mick O'Dwyer said, "You'll never get near him. He's too quick for you." So it was a great game, and we went down to 14 men. Yeah. Brendan Pulley got sent off in the second half of the game when we were still in with a chance. And Brendan is obviously the nephew of Charlie Pulley, the famous Celtic player. And Brendan played soccer with me at Bangor as well for a while, but he got sent off. And I think that was it. Our number was up then. We were outnumbered and they were too strong for us in the end.
Yeah. Mikey Sheehy was on that side as well. So there were a few household names waiting in the wings there. That's amazing you went down to see Paddy. Was that kind of towards the end of his life or back in the 90s, 80s or a bit of both?
It was, I'll tell you when it was. It was about 12, 13 years ago. I was going down for a wedding down in Tralee. And I said, I've got to go in and see Paddy. I haven't seen him for years. I'd spoke to him on the phone a couple of times. And he had asked me to come on and do some stuff for him on his radio show. Right. And I got in trouble for... I was fighting in a soccer game at the end of my career, and he sent me a sort of support message, you know, keep right. punching arms punk, he said, you know. So I was speaking to him on the phone quite a bit, and then I got a chance to go down and see him, and I spent two nights in a row. I did the Friday night and the Saturday night down in Paddy's, and it was great crack. We had a fantastic time. Both of us were up on the stage singing and in his place, and we had a wonderful time.
God, amazing. That is amazing. So in the background, you're like, this is an incredibly accomplished GAA career. Like, you know, people have hung media careers on less, you know what I mean? So you're playing hurling, you're winning All-Irelands, you're playing in under-21 All-Ireland semi-finals against Paddy O'Shea, you're playing for the Antrim Seniors. In the background, when you're kicking a football, soccer ball, football around, on the street or in the playground or whatever, like, are you the best kid in the class? Are people saying to you, geez, do you know what, Jerry, you're damn good at this as well. Would you not think about playing a bit of football?
Never played soccer until I was 16 because I did play a bit in the street, but I never played for any team,
yeah.
any club.
And when you were playing when you were playing on the street, were your mates saying, Jerry, you're bloody good at this as well. You should go and play this seriously, no?
Everybody thought they were George Best then. They were all George Best. They were all Manchester United crazy. And nobody sort of said, you're a great player and they want you to play for your team. Nobody really talked like that. There wasn't too many teams about. It was just street football. Okay. You use lampposts or a couple of cans to make up the goals, and it was just energetic fun for everybody. But my chance came when the school team, I played for the school, St. Thomas's school team, and the geography teacher was a guy called Sean Purvis, and he was in charge of the soccer team. And internment had come in obviously in 1969-70, and a lot of the senior pupils at St. Thomas's were interned. Some of them were soccer players, so he was short of two or three players, and I volunteered to play for him. And I went in and played. I did a couple of training sessions with him, and he liked me, and he said, yeah, you'll do. Mm. And he put me in the centre half, and I played centre half for the school team. And then after two, three games, he made me captain. And we won the school. We'd never won it before, and we won it that year. We beat Kerry Fergus High School in the Sir Robin Kinahan Cup. And it was the first and only time I think St. Thomas's school ever won it. And we won the cup. And I came up afterwards to me and introduced himself. And he said he was a scout for Everton Football Club. And he asked me if I'd like to go over on trial. And I said I wasn't interested. I said I don't play soccer really much. I said I've only been playing 3 or 4 months. So I said no. And I left it. And then about 4 or 5 months after that, I got asked to play for St. Paul Swifts, which was a Down and Connor League team.
Right.
And they wanted me as a centre forward, and I played in the Down and Connor for them for quite a few games, and I scored a lot of goals. And then I got suspended from Gaelic. I punched a guy and busted his jaw, and I got sent off and suspended for a month, and I couldn't play any Gaelic, so I needed to do something. So I went with a friend of mine, Vinty O'Riordan, who played soccer. He was a left back, and he said, come on, we'll go down to Crummick Albion and see if we can get a game with them on Saturday. And we went down, and they didn't know me, and they didn't know obviously Vinty too well, and he picked the team of 12, and away he went. The manager was a guy called Sammy Watson, so he took them off, and they were second in the league in the Down and Connor then. or sorry, not the Donegal, the amateur league they were in. And he took them off to play. And I said, is that it? I said, we're not going to get a game. And he went, no, it doesn't look like it. So we were heading home past the back of the City Hall, and there was a couple of guys on the other side of the road, knew Vinti O'Riordan, and said, Vinti, where are you going? He says, we're heading home. He said, just need a game. And he said, yeah. And they were one of the bottom teams in that same league, and they were playing the top team in the league, and they were Old Park Celtic. And he said, do you fancy coming and playing with us? We're short of players. And I said, can I get a game? And he says, where do you play? Anywhere up front. And he said, no problem. So I went and played for them, and we beat the top team in the league that day 4-1, and I scored the 4 goals. So I went home and had a good day. And then the next thing, knock at the door, and it was Sammy Watson, the manager of Crumic Albion. And he said, listen, big man, he said, you're playing for me next week. So that's how I started playing for Crumic Albion.
And then
but only played three games for Crumic Albion. That was a crazy thing. And then Bangor Football Club spotted me, and they took me off the Bangor, and the rest is all history.
The rest is all history. Jeez, it's a bit mad. There must be, I mean, we'll touch on other aspects of your career. That's a real, like, what are the odds kind of a moment, isn't it?
Well, I think if it's meant to be, it's meant to be. And it's just fate. Yeah. That's the sort of thing. I love training. I love football. I love running. And I was always a good athlete. And, you know, when I'm moving, and the Gaelic helped me so much. The Gaelic and hurling helped me so much because you're playing on a big pitch. And it's a physical game, and it was more physical then. I'm not as much a fan of the Gaelic now because too many hand passes for me.
Yeah,
you know, it was much better, I think, in my day. Hurling's still great. I love watching the hurling. The hurling's amazing, and it's fastest amateur team sport in the world, and it's just great to watch. The eyeball coordination, and it's just a wonderful spectacle. That's why I was caught up in Dublin when the two semi-finals were on, you know.
Yeah,
I couldn't believe
it's amazing.
As well. I couldn't believe it when there were 5 points up.
Yeah. So, like, hand on heart, if you had to be as objective as possible, what were you best at of those three sports?
Without a shadow of a doubt, I was the best sort of young Gaelic footballer in Northern Ireland, Ulster. And the fact that I would have probably got an All-Star, but I played soccer, and that wasn't looked upon.
No.
Too kindly then, so because of the rules. Wow. And if I hadn't been playing for Bangor, I would certainly probably have been an All-Star. And, you know, when I left my own club, I had 7 uncles who played for St. John's the Gallaghers. And they were all brothers, and they all played in the same team. And they weren't happy with me playing soccer. And but they all said when I left, a big chunk of the club went as well because I was the future. I was one of the young players coming through. Andy McCallion played in the same team as me, and he was an All-Star. Andy was a cracking footballer, great forward. And Jerry McCann, we had a lot of really good top-class players, but they were all getting older, and I was one of the future players. So I would say I was a much better Gaelic footballer than I was soccer player. But I took the skills from the Gaelic and the strength and the power. Yeah. I remember playing against Kevin Moran.
Yeah.
I think it was the other quarter or semi-final of the National Football League at Croke Park. And we run them close that day, but they were a wee bit too physical for that Antrim team. They were too strong for us. And but I did score a very good goal in that match, and we pushed them all the way. But that was last games because I must have been around 20, 21 then, and I didn't play much more Gaelic football after that. Once I went to Tottenham, my career obviously changed, and I had to concentrate on another sport.
Yeah. Geez, amazing. I was going to see if you tried to pull a Kevin Moran and fly home during the summer and play for Antrim after you joined Spurs. No, that wasn't on the cards.
Wasn't on the cards, no. Although I did sneak one summer. I played for a team in London and played a quarterfinals against the Kingdom. And they were quite a good team, physical team. And we managed to win that match. We won the quarterfinals and the semi-final. But it got too violent, and because it was a professional footballer and I shouldn't have been playing, you know, I didn't want to risk it for the final. But they went on and won it. The Geraldines have played for in London.
So you go to Spurs 1975 to 1980. That was, you know, quite an exciting time for Spurs as well, especially as things progressed. And then you went to Watford, and this is the Graeme Taylor, John Barnes, Elton John, Luther Blissett era, like amazing. How did you take to London life? You know, the boy from West Belfast caught over there.
Never been on a plane before, you know. I think my first flight was when I was at Bangor. I was about 18 or 19. So I hadn't been in London before. So it was all new to me. And settling down and I stayed in Diggs for the first 2 or 3 months. I was in Diggs with Chris McGrath, who played for Tottenham and for Northern Ireland internationally, he moved then to Manchester United. Chris, he was in Diggs with me, but it took me a wee while to settle down, but I loved it. I loved the fact that I was getting paid to train and do something that I loved every day, which was playing football and being involved in sport.
Mm. And did you find yourself pretty quickly of a level with the fellow players who'd been kicking a football around since they were 2 or 3? Did you kind of settle in quickly enough and get to grips with the standard?
No. It took longer than I thought, Joe, because after a couple of months, I used to train in the morning with the first team and the reserves, and then I'd go in the afternoon with the youth team players who were all 16, 17.
Right.
And you have to understand, in that youth team was Glenn Hoddle, and I could never, ever, and still could never, ever do what he did in the gym with the ball with either foot. He was such a talented player. But he made me think about my game, and I worked every afternoon. I came in and trained every afternoon and worked on my skills and my technique, my control, because that was where I was short. I'd only been playing soccer 3 years. They'd all played it all their life. So I worked on that part of my game. But I learned very quickly from Glenn about his technique, because he could do anything with the ball with either foot.
Yeah.
And not everybody was as gifted as him. But I realized that I was stronger than they were. I was quicker than they were. I had a better attitude and determination. So I had to play to my strengths.
Mm.
And I adapted my game to my strengths. And shortly after that, about 6 months into my contract, I ended up on the subs bench at Everton with the first team, and we beat them 2-0. I didn't come on. I didn't make my debut till the following season, but that was me on the track.
Mm.
Good progress after that, and I played to my strengths.
Amazing. Would someone like Hoddle have been helpful to you and say, well, this is how I do it, this is what I'm thinking, or is he such a genius that actually he's not even able to express half of what he's doing?
He was just a natural. And
yeah.
He wasn't big-headed or anything like that, but he used to go into the gym, and Peter Shreves was the youth team coach at the time, and he loved technique and skills, and he'd say, Glenn, I want you to tip the ball into the circle on the wall, and as it comes off the wall, I want you to control it on your chest, and before it hits the ground, I want you to volley it into the goal at either end, whichever end you want.
Yeah.
And he said, okay, Pete. He said, do you want me to hit it with my right foot or my left foot? And he said, don't mind. He said, whatever you want. I thought, this guy's having a laugh, isn't he? He's joking. But he tipped the ball with his right foot, and then he controlled it on his chest and hit it with his left foot straight in the top corner of the goal. And I went, oh my God, how are you to follow that? You know, there's the demonstration, follow that. And nobody could follow that.
Yeah.
So it was in a bit of awe, but I realized what a fabulous player he was. And then short after that, before me, he broke into the first team and he scored a 25, 30-yard screamer against Peter Shilton, who was then the England goalkeeper. And he scored from a long way out, top corner. And no, Glenn was still young in development. But I learned from Glenn as well, because he broke through into the international team for England around the same time I broke into the Northern Ireland team.
Right.
And I was playing maybe a wee bit before him, but Glenn had so much talent. And he played one game for England against Bulgaria, and he scored an unbelievable goal. And the following game, they left him out of the squad. Ron Greenwood left him out of the squad. And he was just totally shell-shocked. And him and I, after training, went and had a coffee. And I said, what's wrong? He said, the squad's just been announced for England. And I went, oh, right, because he had scored a month earlier in the friendly match against Bulgaria. And he says, I'm not in the team. And I went, what? I said, and I thought, well, if he can't get into the England team, what chances are? He would walk into any team. But his talent wasn't really recognised at that time. He was such a talented player.
Yeah.
I don't think people realised how good he was.
Yeah, it would have been interesting to see him come through in this day and age with that kind of talent and what he might do. The move to Watford then, so this is such an exciting, there's probably younger listeners, and it really is amazing what was going on at Watford. I didn't live through it either, but I'm fairly au fait with it. And you've got Graeme Taylor, the up-and-coming manager. You've got Elton John adding a touch of glamour to the whole thing. Like, it's insane, really. Elton John, you've got the Barnes, coming, like, what a player he was, and Luther Blissett and all these guys. To go up from the old second division, everybody expects the newcomers to struggle to stay up. That's kind of the deal. And to finish second to Liverpool that year, I think you scored their first goal in the top flight. I mean, that must have been just a fun time. I don't know, you're hanging out with Elton John much, Graeme Taylor, what was he like? What are your memories of that period?
That was a really important period for me, because at Tottenham, we had such a big squad, and I had a couple of years after I joined, two, 3 years after I joined Spurs, we had a problem on tour 1 year, and it was at centre half. And of course, I went in and played centre half because I would have been the quickest player at the club and also very committed and strong, and wouldn't pull out of tackles or anything like that. So they put me in at centre half and I did too well. So the manager said, Keith Bergen just said, I'm going to put you in at centre half. He said, I've got plenty of centre forwards. I want to play you at centre half. Right. So I want to play up front. I didn't want to play at the back. But I ended up playing a lot of games for Spurs at centre half, a lot, probably more than I should have, because he wanted me to play there. And that's why I asked for a transfer in 1979. I said, you know, I want to play. And it was easy for him to put me on the bench. He only had one sub then. And I could go on the bench and he could play me at right back. I played right back for Spurs. I played centre half. I played midfield. And I played up front, of course, occasionally. But that's the position I wanted. And Graham Taylor, unbeknown to me, had been chasing me for a year at Watford. And eventually they let me go for a record fee. And when I joined them, he told me he'd been trying to get me. And they were third or fourth bottom of the second division, the old championship then. And but they had a couple of games in hand and they had been involved in a cup run. And we got ourselves out of the trouble. I signed it exactly the same week as Pat Rice and Les Taylor.
Right.
Les had come from Oxford as a midfield player. Pat had come from Arsenal as a right back. And we all joined at the same time. And we went on a really good run and finished well up the table by the end. And then he set a stall out and told us that we were going to get promoted the next year. He said, this is our goal and this is what we're going for. Now, I'd taken them from the fourth to the third and the third to the second. So he had planned on taking them from the second to the first. And obviously with the impetus he got from Elton John and everybody else at the club. But he was an amazing manager, absolutely amazing manager. He was so focused. And he got me fitter. And I didn't think I could get fitter when I left Tottenham. Right. And he got me fitter than I'd ever been in my life. And we trained so hard. You know, we were like an athletics club.
Right.
But the focus and that he was great with the stuff around the mind, psychology, and giving you the right attitude and making you focus on your game. And he was a breath of fresh air for me. And I learned an awful lot in that 3 years I was at Watford. But John Barnes wasn't in the first team the first year I was there. He only came in the following year.
Mm.
A young 16-year-old developing, and he played in the youth team. And Luther Blissett and myself would play up front. And we had some good players, but the likes of Kenny Jackett came through as a midfield player. He played in the youth team as well. Steve Terry played at centre-half. Jimmy Gilligan came through. There was a lot of young players coming in from Watford, and that was down to Tommy Wally, who was the youth coach development officer. He was amazing, and he brought some cracking players through. So all of that talent came through. And Graham Taylor with Nigel Callaghan on the right wing, who was an under-21 player, and John Barnes on the left wing. We had width and we had players who could cross a ball and could do magical things.
Right.
So I just had to get on the end of them with Luther Blissett. And obviously we went up that year. We got promoted with a couple of games to go. Elton was hands-on all the time. He'd go to every game when he was home. The night that we beat, I think it was Wrexham we beat to get promoted, Elton phoned from Norway. He had been doing a concert there and he was on the phone from 10, 11 o'clock at night. And he spoke to everybody in the club, every member of staff, in the director's boardroom, and he spoke to everyone individually and was on the phone till 1, 2 in the morning talking to them all. And he was hands-on. The last week before, the Sunday before the season kicked off, we used to go to Elton's place in Windsor for a big party. And flying by helicopter, it was amazing. They were just fantastic. And everybody, every member of staff, whether it was the groundsmen or the people who sweep the streets, you know, on the terraces, they were all invited to it. They all came, and there was a convoy used to go on that Sunday every year and have the party at Elton's. And he was great entertainment, top man he was.
I presume he sang a few songs for you.
He did. And you know, it's crazy. See, at the end of the season, we went on tour to China, and at the end of the Chinese tour, he had a piano put on the stage, and he got up and he played. He says, right, whatever you want me to play, tell me. And we would show Candle in the Wind or Rocket Man, and he'd play anything you wanted.
Wow.
And did that at Christmas as well when we had our Christmas do's. He was just an amazing person.
Class, that is amazing. God. I guess I want to talk to you a bit about Northern Ireland as well. Just to, like, it's a mad thing, and you know, we're just over 50 years on from the civil rights movement, and you would remember that era, I'm sure, very well, and the West Belfast community looking for their rights effectively. And who could have thought the whole thing would turn the way it did so badly in the 70s? you know, because it's funny, even in your story, you mention a few of the classmates were victims of internment, you know, and that's why they're not there. Or, you know, I saw you tell a story when Ricky Villa signed, and he kind of said, you know, he's talking to you and he said, "Where are you from?" And you said, "Belfast." And he said, "Oh, Belfast." And he sort of swung his arm as if to gesture a grenade. You know, this is what it is. So, like, that spectre of violence is there. How close did the violence come to your home, to your family, to your friends? How upsetting, distressing, awful was it to watch from a distance? Or were you glad in many ways to be away from it, Jerry?
It was surreal, to be honest, because it was as if we were living in a movie set every day. And it was every day. You know, from 1969-70, it just escalated and went from one level to the next. It used to be the barricades went up and there was buses burned. And then the petrol bombs came in after the stones. And there were rocks and stones, and then petrol bombs came in, and then there was guns. And it just escalated, and it got bigger and bigger. And it was crazy. Mm. You know, it was crazy. I don't know how the people actually got through it, because it was a really difficult time for everyone in the community. Mm. And I had two A-levels, and I wanted to be an architect. And I went into an architect's office on the Malone Road, Danny McRandall's, and I wanted to be an architect. And after a year, I wasn't sort of so keen on it because I was bored. And then I joined the Northern Ireland Housing Executive and I went into the commercial property section and worked there until I actually moved to Tottenham. But life was not normal. Mm. It wasn't normal for anybody. We basically, you didn't know what was going to happen each day. Bombs going off. I remember coming out of the office one day and said it was another bomb scare. And we had that many scares, it was untrue. Like, they became regular every week. And nothing had happened in the previous six or seven. And I was not too quick getting down the stairs to get out. And I remember myself and a couple of others were walking away. And we were maybe 50, 100 yards away from the housing executive entrance when the bomb went off in a pillar box. They put it through a pillar box. And it wasn't even so much the devastation. It was the noise. And it scares the life out of you. Mm. And we hit the floor. And those are sort of things. But the next time we were first down the stairs, I promise you, when we were,
I'm sure,
the alarm went off, we were down the stairs, because you learn, or you have to learn, you know, because it did cost lives. And obviously lots of friends and family I have known have died as a result of the Troubles. You know, I had family who died in the Omagh bombing, you know, a second cousin who died there. Right. And she was only 17. So there's lots of things like that. And it affected every single household.
And when you were over in London at Spurs and then Watford, what close family of yours were at home? Like, were mum and dad still around then, or brothers or sisters? Or,
yeah, my mum and dad stayed in Belfast, obviously, until 1982, till after the World Cup. And then my father, who was a driving examiner, he had to move back to his hometown. He was from County Tyrone, and he moved back to Omagh. And he took most of the family with him. The others, a lot of the others were all married. And I had my brother Kevin over in St Albans with me. I lived in St Albans near Watford. And my brother Kevin came over. He was an electrician. And then my sister came over, Grania and Sinead, they came over. And half the family ended up moving to England. Mm. And then I had a sister who was living in Dublin and still does live down in Dublin, my sister Mary.
Right.
We had family all over the place, but I still had, obviously, brothers and sisters.
So, like, at home. The thing which I always, you know, when you talk about the people and how they get through it, the thing that always strikes me about it more than anything is to live with the constant threat of random violence, you know, wrong place, wrong time, at any given moment. The stress, whether you even know it's stress or not, that must have been on everybody up there. I don't know how you get used to that, but I guess you do in some weird way. But for you to be getting up every morning and turning on Terry Wogan, maybe the Irish Voice, or turning on the radio in the morning, or checking the papers, or watching the evening news, like, did you, it must have been a constant worry, or did you get used to it? Like, you don't want that horrible phone call from home, or to see that horrible news bulletin from home.
Listen, we were the evening news every day. We were the evening news when I was living in London. There was always stuff going on in Belfast. And, you know, you wanted to listen in and find out what was happening. And I would spoke to my father and mother, you know, every day virtually.
Right.
And I spoke to brothers and sisters. So we were always in constant contact. But we were aware of what was going on, and it was just a question of trying to keep out of trouble, try not be in the wrong place at the wrong time, and get on with your life. It was so difficult. That's why the people in Northern Ireland are so resilient.
Mm.
You know, and I talk about, you know, the number of superstars have come out of Northern Ireland for playing snooker for playing golf, you know, and well done Shane as well. Mm. But the number of stars we've had, the Rory McIlroys, the Darren Clarks, you know, the Graham McDowells, these small population, how do you get so many talented players? Dennis Taylor won the world championship, and you've got Alex Higgins, who was just a phenomenon. Mm. And we have world-class boxers, we have, you know, athletes, cyclists, we've got everything. So there's something, I think, the way the troubles had an effect on people like that made them a lot more resilient, a lot tougher than maybe the normal Joe out there. And I'm sure it's got to be something like that. But, you know, we have produced, I mean, the team that qualified in 1982 for the World Cup and then again in 86. Mm. You know, we qualified out of a group with Portugal. You know, how do we qualify when we've got Portugal in our group? Mm. So it's crazy. And it's happened. It's happened not once. It's happened twice and three times. So it's not a fluke. So the people, I think, are special. They have to have sort of resilience and a determination and an attitude. You know, I think everybody up here, glass is always half full. It's never half empty.
Yeah. So you played 63 times for Northern Ireland. You played at the 82 World Cup, obviously scored that very famous goal, and you played in 86. And was there any part of you that thought, well, I might go and play for the Republic? Like, did you look at Northern Ireland and did that represent something very difficult for you to accept, or like your relationship with Northern Ireland as it was then?
It was never an option because, you know, in the 1970s when we played, they talked about having an All-Ireland team together. Mm. And the manager at the time was Danny Blanchflower, and Johnny Giles, who was my boss at West Brom, he was the manager of the Republic. And I think he was player manager as well, Johnny. Yeah. But anyway, the two teams, we were due to meet each other. And the question arose, and Danny Blanchflower and all the players had said, we'd love to play in one team. And, you know, obviously having the quality. And I think the Republic probably had better players then in those days. If you look at Liam Brady, and who's a friend of mine, and Frank Stable, Dave O'Leary, all my mates who played, you know, in London. And I think they probably had a better team. But it was agreed. Everybody was all for it. But the two associations were never going to come to terms with it because of the involved, and of course from a UEFA and a FIFA point of view, and I think the Northern Irish FA are one of the oldest in the world. They were established before a lot of other football associations, so they never wanted to give up their position as one of the leaders. And I think Harry Kavanagh told me at the time, a long time ago, he was a FIFA vice president, that it was important that they kept the British Isles as it was, because Wales had a vote, England had a vote, Scotland had a vote, the Republic of Ireland had a vote, and Northern Ireland had a vote. So there was votes coming out of the British sides, and the European and African teams were trying to get one team, and that would then put a little bit more power towards the African nation. So there was a lot of politics went on, which we didn't know about at the time, but we never, ever were given that option, never added to us. But the players would have loved to have played, and I know Pat Jennings and Brian Hamilton, Alan Hunter, they all played in that game against Brazil. The famous game that Derek Dugan organised.
Yeah.
And that was something special, and it shows you what you could have done if you had the talent that we had at our disposal.
And so you never had any issue playing for Northern Ireland and you know, God Save the Queen and playing with people across the community?
No, God Save the Queen was the national anthem for Northern Ireland at the time, so you know, we just got on with it. We had no choice whether you liked it or not. I still think it would be a good idea if they had a different national anthem for Northern Ireland. I think it would be a good idea if they, you know, I actually spoke to Gary Lightbody from Snow Patrol and said, would you write a song? And he says, I would. You know, so that would obviously help. But I think it's a wee bit at a time. And in the last 8 to 10 years, I've seen a huge amount of progress made by the Irish FA, you know, in terms of sectarianism, in terms of, you know, stopping the chanting. And the Northern Ireland fans over the last 6 years involved in European football and everything else have proven that they're a special set of fans. They've been great on tour and whenever they went away, and they've got praise from all over the world. So, you know, we're moving in the right direction. Mm. And I think a lot of other countries could take a leaf out of our book.
And in your day, did what was going on off the field, did that ever affect the atmosphere in the dressing room?
No. It was never, because, you know, once you start playing for a team, it's like when you go to London and then you move from Tottenham to Watford, you have another set of teammates, you know, and it wasn't a question of religion. It was a question, these are my mates, and there's 11 of us going up against 11 of them. And you have to have, and we were actually very, very much a special unit. In 1980 and 81, 82, there was 11 players who bonded. And, you know, when you played against the Northern Ireland team, we won the British Championships in 1980. And then we won it again in 1984, 85. And and we've only ever won it three times in over 100 years. So in my year, we won it twice. And I know the bond there was between the players, the Billy Hamiltons and the Jimmy Nicholls and the Pat Jennings and the Martin O'Neills. There was a real bond and there was a competitive edge, but we were one together, one unit. And that's what you have to be when you play on the pitch if you want to win games.
Yeah, I guess you can't go to the 82 World Cup and the 86 World Cup and do what you did if you weren't one. You've described the goal a billion times, I know. I did read one nice thing from that evening where you talked. It was in Valencia and you said afterwards, you know, after that goal against Spain, I sat with Pat Jennings on a balcony and we watched the sun come up, which sounded a nice way to spend that night.
Well, it was about 5 o'clock in the morning when we actually went to bed, and it was a fun because two or three balconies down was the famous Malcolm Brodie, who was a reporter for the Belfast Telegraph. But he wrote for about 15 different newspapers all over the world, and he was typing copy at 5 o'clock in the morning. And Pat and I went up, and the players, we'd had a fantastic night, and we qualified. We'd also been told that Billy Bingham wasn't happy about 1:30, 2 in the morning when he told us that he had just been informed by our secretary that he didn't think we would qualify, so he hadn't booked a hotel for us in Madrid for the quarterfinals, which didn't go too well. But we left it to them to sort out, and we just celebrated. And all the players were having a ball. It was fantastic. We had a great squad of lads, really great squad of lads. Right. And we ordered some tea and toast, and Pat and I sat in the balcony and thought, does it get any better than this? You know, we qualified for the quarterfinals of the World Cup, and it was our first ever World Cup. And Pat, you know, at that time, I think he was 37, maybe 38, and he thought he wasn't going to make a World Cup. Little did he know, 4 years later, he'd be doing it all over again.
Yeah. I guess a point to finish on then, because time is against us and we could have talked to you forever. The impact that goal has on the rest of your life, do you end up in Sky for 20 years doing La Liga? I presume you don't end up at Real Mallorca. Is that kind of one of those, again, we started the piece chatting about those kind of, those random moments that affect your life in a big way for years to come. Does that goal, is that the passport into the Spanish world that you inhabit then for the next 20, 30 years?
Yeah, I think so. I think, again, it's fate plays a big part. The president of Real Mallorca, a few months later, has looked at me and seen my performances in Spain, and he needed a centre forward, and he contacted Watford Football Club, and I spoke to them. And I'd just come back from a broken leg and broken ankle, and I thought, you know what? You know, you can't play forever. And it was a great opportunity for me to go and play in Spain and find out about another type of football. And it was totally different then. So that's why I went to Spain and to Mallorca. And as a result of the 2 years in Mallorca, I came back. And then George Best put me in contact with the right people at Chrysalis and Sky. Right. He was working with them. And he said, if you want to find out about Spanish, he said, Jerry Armstrong is your man. He's been there for 2 years and he speaks Spanish. So he got me in touch with them and I started working on Sky Sports, and I did 22 years on Spanish La Liga with Sky.
Yeah. Yeah, and brilliantly so as well. I think everyone really loved the Sky coverage of La Liga. Listen, Jerry, what a pleasure. That was even more interesting than I thought it was going to be, and I knew it would be pretty interesting. I didn't know I was in the presence of such GAA excellence all these years, but I'm glad we picked our way through this evening. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Joe.
Off the Ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.